Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today, who is on his way to the political event of the year. He's going to the vice presidential debate down in Farmville, Virginia. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives. And we'll start right there with the good, and the term is used with some reservation today. Ian, first of all, good to have you back. What we've got today, of course, is the lone vice presidential debate. It's Mike Pence on the Republican side. It's Tim Kaine on the Democratic side. The good news is that I would say both of these candidates are more reputable and more honorable than the people at the top of the ticket. Mike Pence can actually articulate conservatism, I have a feeling. We'll find out tonight how well he is at it. But I'm guessing he won't let so many opportunities to defend and advance conservatism go by as Trump did last week. And, of course, you've got Tim Kaine, who will present himself as the folksy, middle-of-the-road guy who can relate to everybody when, in fact, he's a knee-jerk liberal. So what are you looking forward to tonight?
Yeah, so the good part of tonight's event is that it doesn't feature anyone named Trump or Hillary. That's the what we have to look forward to. I think it was Jonah Goldberg here at National Review who tweeted this morning, "If I do say so myself, I'm doing a pretty good job containing my excitement for the evening," which is fair. But to be fair to both of these guys, I think what's interesting, and I might just be flat out wrong about this, and we'll have to see. But it's typical for the vice presidential candidates to be the attack dogs. The presidential candidates, sort of at least historically, are supposed to be a little bit above the fray, you know, painting their optimistic vision of the future, and the VP folks underneath are doing some of the real combat. I think it might actually be the opposite this year. I think we'll see some hits, both sides going after the guys at the top of the ticket and each other. But especially with Pence, I wouldn't be surprised if you see him trying to do what I thought Donald Trump should have done in the first debate, which is absorb the blows that you really can't avoid and then use them to pivot to a message of here's what we're going to do, here's why we'll be better, et cetera. My criticism, one of the reasons that I think Hillary is floundering to the extent that she is, even after this post-debate bump, is she's painted herself as, you know, vote for me because I'm not Donald Trump. And people don't like voting against someone. They want to vote for someone. I would think that Pence will try to capitalize a bit on that tonight. And so you might see a little bit more positivity, so to speak, from him. And then, Tim Kaine, who's more Catholic than the Pope, at least he says, is going to try and paint himself as kind of the character that John Edwards tried to be back in 2004. You know, John Edwards' father was a mill worker. And John Kasich's father was a mailman.
No.
I know, all news. I wouldn't be surprised if you see some of that, Hillary being as unrelatable as she is. So if those predictions pan out, what you might see is actually a debate where we get a little bit of substance and a little bit of here's what we're offering, and take that all with a pillar of salt. And then, Jim can come on tomorrow and say that was the most pugnacious, nasty, a debate we've ever seen between two VPs, and I'll hang my head in shame.
Yeah, man. We have had some interesting vice presidential moments. There was Dick Cheney telling John Edwards he'd never even seen him on Capitol Hill. Everyone, of course, was waiting to see what Sarah Palin would do on the debate stage. And I'm guessing we're not going to hear the word malarkey tonight, which is almost guaranteed if Joe Biden's involved, but he's not tonight. So
it's just a shame, too. I mean, the level of public discourse.
The Twitter war has already begun. At 8:48 today, from Hillary Clinton, Mike Pence, a divisive, anti-woman, anti-LGBT, anti-worker extremist. No wonder Trump picked him, #VP debate. So the first salvo comes from Hillary, and let's Let's break this down a little bit, Ian. Anti-woman means Mike Pence thinks that babies in the womb should be allowed to live. Anti-LGBT means that he believes in religious liberty and that people shouldn't be forced to do things that violate their conscience. And anti-worker means that workers should have the option of joining a union. And have the option not to. So a total extremist, that Mike Pence.
The recommendation for Mike Pence is a lot of what he did in Indiana. The recommendation against Mike Pence is that he agreed to be on the Trump ticket. I mean, that's basically what you sort of have to say here. The problem with this is I take this critique from people who are more sympathetic to Trump than I am, is all the things that she said about Mike Pence in that tweet, she said about Romney, or Democrats said about Romney in 2012, and they said about McCain in 2008, and they said it again about Bush, and you can go back and back and back, and the rhetoric's all the same. They went straight for the top shelf in their rhetoric on guys that were actually pretty tame, and now it's come to Donald Trump, and they really have nothing left in the bag. So those criticisms don't hit home the way that they need them to. And that's a trap of their own making. I'm not sympathetic.
Excellent point. And actually, this tweet could have been used against her 8 years ago because, she only paid her Senate staff 70 some cents on the dollar.
Right,
at that time,
right,
she was against gay marriage. Amazingly, what happened once the polls changed for her. And I guess the same thing can go with the anti-workers. So, I guess she was an extremist just 8 years ago. So anyway, on to the second martini now, the bad martini. And Republicans are in a bad place exactly 5 weeks before Election Day when, to a large extent, their hopes for pulling ahead of Hillary Clinton and defeating her are, oh, man, I hope Julian Assange has something big on Hillary. That's not a good position to be in. Pretending that he's a good guy is also not a good position to be in. But today was supposed to be the big reveal. First, he was going to do this public announcement on the balcony of the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's been holed up for a number of years now because he's trying not to be extradited back to Sweden to face rape charges. So instead, he appears on camera at this conference in Berlin. And you've got all these pro-Trump people staying up in the middle of the night expecting this massive data dump and huge revelations. No, just an announcement that there's going to be an announcement. Here's Julian Assange.
We hope to be publishing every week for the next 10 weeks. Now, we have on schedule, and it's a very hard schedule, all the U.S. election-related documents to come out before November 8th. Our upcoming series includes significant material from war, on arms, on oil, on Google, on the U.S. election, and on mass surveillance.
And so, Ian, as Jim pointed out today, does Julian Assange know that there's such a thing as early voting and that 46 million people took advantage of this? Secondly, the thing that I don't know what people were expecting him to reveal today or what's going to come in these extra revelations, but when you look at his list, war, arms, Google, mass surveillance, there might be something weird or really damaging to Hillary Clinton in there, but those don't seem like issues that the media seems to care about, which means that I don't know how much traction these things are going to get. It's hard to say until we know what he's got, but those don't seem like the issues that are going to have tongues wagging.
No, that's quite right. And as you say, it's a ridiculous position to be in, to be depending on Julian Assange. I mean, the man's unhinged. And not to mention that it's just flagrant hypocrisy, since so many on the right, including so many of the people that are now touting his role in breaking, important news about state secrets and the rest, were 2 years ago condemning him and his collaboration with Edward Snowden as treasonous, at least in Snowden's case. This is just – it's really a sign of the moral lapse of the right that's been – associated with Trump. And it's more dependence on the sort of conspiracy mongering element of right wing media to come through. The reason I think that the right has depended on that in part is because there always have been expectations built up about Hillary Clinton that were never going to pan out. You can see this looking back at Benghazi. The House Special Committee on Benghazi's report was utterly damning about her incompetence and her negligence when it came to providing security for American diplomatic personnel in Libya. They came out, the report is very strong on all the things that she did terribly wrong that facilitated what went wrong. But Republicans had ratcheted up expectations so high that they basically expected Hillary Clinton to be operating Al-Qaeda drones. They expected her to be, in the compound helping burn things down. And that was never going to be the case. And I think that that's given the media in part, they were never going to be hard against Hillary, but they don't necessarily like her that much, not compared to the way they like Obama. It's helped give them an out by saying, look at these right-wing crazies. Anything that comes out of this cesspool is obviously nonsense, and it gives them a little more leeway not to report on it. And by giving up the duty to make the case against Hillary to Julian Assange and whatever documents he may or may not have in his pocket is just furthering that narrative of right-wing irresponsibility, making it easier for her to get off the hook on the things that she really should be punished and taken to the woodshed for.
Well, of course, Julian Assange made his name, first of all, with WikiLeaks, with the Bradley Manning document leak. And as we transition to Martini number three, in case you've missed it recently, the United States government has agreed to pay for Bradley Manning's sex change procedures. And that dovetails pretty well here in what the military is up to under President Obama here towards the end of his presidency. This is courtesy of the Navy Times, and this is dated September 29th, so late last week. The Navy deep-sixed all of its 91 enlisted ratings titles Thursday, marking the beginning of an overhaul of the rigid career structure that has existed since the Continental Navy, in a radical shift sure to reverberate through the fleet and the veterans community beyond. Sailors will no longer be identified by their job title, say Fire Controlman First Class Joe Sailor, effective immediately. Instead, that would be just Petty Officer First Class Joe Sailor. Officials say the controversial move will improve sailors' lives and ease their transition into the civilian workforce by broadening their skills in this tectonic shift in the Navy's personnel system to redraw the traditional lines between enlisted job specialties, a massive shakeup that is only beginning. The story goes on to say that Secretary of the Navy Ray Mabus, this is not his first go-around with changing the culture inside the military. In June, the Marine Corps, also under the Mabus edict, announced they'd take man out of 19 occupational titles as well. The Navy's newly released answer is to take a much more difficult and controversial approach by scrapping their existing system and starting over. And by the way, Ray Mabus is the guy who decided to start naming Navy ships after liberal activists such as Harvey Milk and Cesar Chavez instead of military heroes. So, Ian, what do you make of the cultural pressure being forced on our military?
Two things here. One's good and one's bad. It is true that there's a problem with reintegration after military service, especially among combat veterans, that needs to be addressed. And there are reforms that can be made to make that transition easier. To the extent that any of our military branches are actively trying to pursue this in a way that is both responsible to the needs of the military when men are in the service and then also responsible afterward, I think is prudent. And, we can hopefully those will yield good changes. Let's say that to start with. But, and it's a big, large, Kardashian size, but the Navy and the rest of the military, although the Navy and Army and Marines have been sort of at the forefront of this, are being reshaped to just to put it simply, to cop to a liberal ideological view of what the military should look like, and it's patently insane. It has nothing to do with the competence of the service, especially the competence of servicemen and women to perform in combat situations. It has everything to do with making sure that the average military unit looks like the average Oberlin classroom. And it's not just nonsense, but it's dangerous. I would encourage, on this subject, go back and scroll through the archives of my colleague David French, who served in Iraq and who's written extensively about this, and Aaron McLean, who I believe was formerly in the Navy, who's at the Washington Free Beacon and has also written extensively about this. What they're doing is not creating the type of centripetal forces that bind units together, but creating situations that fragment. And given that military units have to perform under the most extreme pressures that any people will face in a lifetime, it's not just silly, it's dangerous. For our security at home and for theirs on the battlefield.
Ian, thank you for filling in today. Try to keep the blood pressure under control tonight.
I don't know if I can manage, but it's jumping up and down in my seat and Tim Kaine mania. I mean, yeah, it really is. It's real.
It's a home game for him. It's in Virginia. So
this is true.
We'll see.
True.
We'll see if the point spread reflects that at kickoff time. Have a great day. Talk to you later.
Likewise. Thanks, Greg.
Ian Tuttle of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us. And please be sure to tune in again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.